Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back with you here on The Punch Out 4/16/2021, Friday. Very happy to be with you as we close out the week. And today, as we always do, we've got plenty of important stories for you here. We're going to be talking about Joe Biden's attempt to look tough on Russia. We're also going to be talking about Somalia's political crisis and the role of U.S. imperialism there. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we want to start with corruption in COVID contracting. Big money spent on lobbying greases the wheels in Washington, D.C. in a lot of ways. One big one is in federal contracting. A new study from Public Citizen and the Center for Responsive Politics makes this clear as day, noting that, quote, just 6% of the companies that received COVID-related contracts lobbied the federal government in 2020. But they received more than half of the money that was awarded to combat the pandemic, $19.4 billion. So just 6% of the companies that received COVID-related contracts lobbied the government. But that 6% got over half of the money. They went even further and also noted that, quote, just 2% of the COVID contractors lobbied either the Trump administration or the agency that awarded them a contract and reported lobbying on specific COVID-related issues. These companies received 37% of the money, $13.4 billion. The report also went on to note, quote, the PACs and employees of companies that lobbied their awarding agency or the White House on COVID issues gave $313 million in campaign contributions to Donald Trump, members of Congress, and party committees from the 2016 to 2020 election cycles, end quote. Now, of course, this doesn't necessarily mean that any of these people did anything illegal, but just because they've codified corrupt practices doesn't mean that they aren't necessarily still just that. The issue this raises most directly is the real impact of lobbying. Lobbyists, of course, are resolute that they are not selling access, that they can't guarantee outcomes. They're just offering relationships that may, get a call moved up one or two people on the call sheet and advice on how to generally approach things. And if it works out for you, great. But you aren't paying for access to any particular policymaker or person in the government. Essentially, what lobbyists are trying to do is just prevent anything from causing closer scrutiny on how they operate in terms of getting results for their corporate clients. The fact that such a small number of companies who directly lobbied got such an outsized proportion of federal contracts around COVID, of course, raises the exact opposite suspicion that these lobbyists are indeed selling access. And your ability to afford the right lobbyist is directly related to your ability to get a contract, which, of course, raises the questions of, well, how exactly are these lobbyists getting officials to favor their clients? And one element that points to all of this is that many companies with big contracts were lobbying for the very first time. As the report notes, quote, recipient of $390 million contract for ventilators lobbied for the first time ever in 2020. A separate recipient of $80 million in ventilator contracts lobbied in 2020 for the first time since 2015, end quote. Now, of course, they could have just been the best companies for the job, but companies companies that rarely delve into the federal contracting world, they're just taking advantage of this opportunity. But it also obviously could be, well, they knew who to call. The report tells the story of, quote, North Carolina textiles company Parkdale Mills, which had previously received just one very small government contract. They received nearly $600 million in contracts for masks, gowns, and swabs in the early months of the pandemic. Parkdale hosted Vice President Pence a year earlier for a speech during which Pence touted the trade deal the administration had negotiated with Mexico. Park Mills' CEO has made more than $200,000 in campaign contributions to federal candidates and committees since the 2016 election cycle and gave $60,000 to the National Republican Congressional Committee in early March 2020, just before Parkdale Mills received the spree of massive COVID contracts, end quote. And just don't forget there that Pence was the coordinator of the COVID-19 task force, you may remember. Either way, the report just helps rip some of the veil off of the lobbying industry. I mean, why would corporations spend billions of dollars on lobbying without some knowledge that it actually worked? That hiring the right lobbying firm is going to increase your chances and or assure a certain contractor, regulation, or whatever. Despite the elaborate legal structure to help make these cozy-sounding relationships seem less corrupt than they obviously are, it's clear as day that money secures outcomes better than anything else when it comes to the U.S. government. Just 6% of companies that got a contract in COVID lobbied, but they got over half the money. The almighty dollar is running things in the U.S. government. Somalia is in the midst of a political crisis that has actually raised the possibility of, among other things, U.S. sanctions on the country. President Mohamed Abdulli Mohamed, popularly known as Farmajo, has extended his own term in office by 2 years after Parliament cleared the way for such a move in a decision that's being decried as an anti-democratic power grab by many people. The New York Times reports that, quote, the United States, which has given billions of dollars in aid to Somalia and conducted numerous airstrikes and military raids against al-Shabaab, had privately threatened Mr. Mohamed and his top officials with sanctions and visa restrictions if they disregarded the election timetable, end quote. And publicly as well, the U.S. has been quite critical. A statement came from Anthony Blinken on this the other day, criticizing the move. But unraveling all this requires we take a little bit of a step back here and explain the broader situation. Now, the president, who has extended his term, was elected in 2017. And in an election widely viewed as essentially fraudulent, right? So he was elected, quote unquote, in 2017. But to quote the New York Times again, quote, several analysts, investigators, and some Western diplomats say the election has turned out to be a milestone of corruption, one of the most fraudulent political events in Somalia's history. The entire process has been so bad, several analysts said, that the Shabaab militant group, one of the deadliest Islamist organizations in the world, isn't even trying to derail the vote because the corruption free-for-all almost makes the militants look upstanding by comparison, end quote. And again, that's the New York Times there. But nevertheless, and despite it being obviously fraudulent, the United States has continued to back and support this government and lend it quite a bit of legitimacy on the international stage. So back to the current crisis. Somalia does not really have a central government per se. The government in Mogadishu is really just one power center among several. And really the broader sort of governing coalition is made up of five states, five sort of semi-autonomous states. So even though Mogadishu is the capital of the country and there is this central government, these states have a lot of autonomy. So in Puntland and Jubaland, which is two of these five semi-autonomous states in the broader federal government, quote unquote, of Somalia, the leaders of those two states were at odds with the president over how they should move forward with the next presidential and parliamentary elections. Nevertheless, parliament, some say because the wheels were greased by bribes, decided to allow the president to just go ahead and go his own way here, with some saying it could even end up sparking an expanded civil war between the central government and these regions. Somalia has not had a central government at all, really, since about 1991. Essentially. In 2005, the country was briefly united until a U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion overthrew the Islamic Courts Union regime. Since then, the country has been splintered. An insurgent group, al-Shabaab, and a loose coalition of various regional leaders united under a federal umbrella government backed by the so-called international community, but mainly held up by the U.S., EU, Turkey, various Gulf states, and Eritrea. And the president seems to be moving more judiciously now to concentrate power at the center in Mogadishu with himself. And certainly pushing a hard line on the contours of the election process is part of that trend. Now, his opponents are accusing Qatar and Eritrea, and to an extent Turkey, for giving him backing, hoping to have a strongman-style government, quote-unquote, rather than keep going with the sham democracy that is currently there and that is extremely dysfunctional. And it seems that this is what has really rankled the United States. having recognized the multiple clearly colonial and fraudulent attempts to have elections like in 2017 and have various trappings of government in Somalia, it was obviously important to them that the current president play by the rules of the game so that they can pretend that it was some profound democratic process at play and they were rebuilding Somalia. But his willingness to buck that agenda and potentially make this so-called sham of a democracy, elections and so on, fall apart, will that looks bad for the United States because then it doesn't look like their guy is truly supporting freedom and democracy. And that is what has landed him in hot water with threats of sanctions from the U.S. government. Now, the fear here by many is that the president can't actually unite the country, even if he's moving in that way, and the different regions could start warring with one another, deepening the social crisis in the country. But one thing is for sure, though, the U.S. opposition to these moves isn't about democratic processes or helping Somalia, which has terrible social indicators and is actually listed by some as the most corrupt country on earth, the most corrupt. Yet those officials are supported by the United States. So it's not about improving people's lives. It's just about preserving their own reputation as so-called defenders of democracy. This week, the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Russia. 10 Russian diplomats were expelled from the United States and 32 entities were sanctioned. American banks were also banned from investing in new Russian debt. Russia is vowing a proportionate response to these activities, calling it a quote-unquote degradation of bilateral relations. The principal motivating factor for these actions is the U.S. claim, unveiled officially for the first time here with these sanctions, that the Russian government was behind the massive solar winds hack in 2020 that hit thousands of organizations, including the U.S. government, also the U.K. government, and NATO. The New York Times noted as well that Biden administration officials said they had also sent diplomatic messages to Russia expressing concern about intelligence reports that Russia had paid bounties to encourage Taliban attacks on American troops. The measures were also related to the various accusations of quote-unquote meddling by quote-unquote Russia during the 2016 and 2020 elections. So what to make of all this? Well, to the point we just mentioned, embarrassingly for the administration, after briefing the New York Times on how sanctions were at least obliquely related to the Russian bounty issue, the White House released a report that they had only, quote, low to moderate confidence that that story was even true. As for SolarWinds, that's a bit more complicated. Attribution for hacks is really an educated guessing game. As the Vault 7 release about CIA cyber weapons released by WikiLeaks points out, the CIA, for instance, uses methods that allow them to mask their hacks as, say, a quote-unquote Russian hack, but then set it up so that when investigators are looking into it deeper, it appears to be a quote-unquote North Korean hack, pretending to be a quote-unquote Russian hack. So there's layers on layers here, and sophisticated actors not only mask their presence, but do their best to throw people off their trail. So attribution is basically just the massive circumstantial evidence. It can be weak or strong, but it's not a 100% thing. But that's not the point. If it can just be plausibly pinned on Russia, it serves the broader U.S. interest of building hostility towards a country it views as an adversary. There are documented cases of all sorts of U.S. allies not only manipulating the U.S. election process, but spying in sensitive areas. But those countries are rarely presented as an existential threat. So the White House has seized on an almost impossible to verify assertion and a report that they themselves have low confidence in being true to launch what every media outlet on earth is calling quote unquote stiff sanctions. Why? Well, it narrows the scope for cooperation between the two countries. Cooperation requires compromises and compromises require trust. So by eroding any atmosphere of trust and creating an atmosphere of bad intentions, it limits compromises and cooperation. Assuming bad faith obviously affects any negotiation strategy. The president, and also the last president, by the way, and most of Congress have deemed Russia to be a strategic threat, which means even if their alleged behavior is the same as a close ally, because of their differing worldviews, the Russian action becomes a major point of conflict, while with the ally, it becomes just part of the broader relationship around the shared goals internationally. Biden then is showing how tough he is on Russia with this. Now, it's generally believed that the sanctions, while the toughest in a while, may not have a real economic bite. So really, they're aimed much more at the U.S. domestic audience, who, at least he thinks, want him to look tough on Russia. Adding to the general climate of Russia is a bad, bad enemy and must be considered to be always acting out of a desire to destroy the United States, making exploring more engagement rather than a new Cold War-style confrontation seem treasonous. Ultimately, it's a weapon in the information warfare being employed to justify America's attempts to short-circuit any sort of challenge to its unipolar domination.
That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.